What impact will central bank digital currencies have on the financial system? There's been a great deal of activity among central banks and the Bank for International Settlements around developing and experimenting with central bank digital currencies, or CBDCs. It is clear that CBDCs, depending on their design, could have a profound impact on the financial system and even society in general. Hi, I'm Justin Pugsley, editor of Global Risk Regulator. And if you'd like to learn more about the publication, please contact my colleague, Ella Jacob at ella.jacob@ft.com. To discuss the potential impact of CBDCs, I'm delighted to introduce John Velisarios, Blockchain and Multi-Party Systems, Digital Assets Custody and CBDC Lead at Accenture, and Kimo Soramanki, Founder and CEO at FNA. Kimo has previously worked for central banks such as the European Central Bank, the New York Federal Reserve, and the Bank of Finland. John, let me start with you. Most of the world's central banks have CBDC projects, but the language about them from some of the leading Western central banks is quite cautious. So do you think dollar, euro, yen, or sterling digital currencies are inevitable? And if so, within what time frame?
It's an excellent question. I think we have come to the conclusion that it's an inevitability, I think, in terms of CBDCs with the leading sort of central banks around the world. Okay. The time frame is the magic question, or the million-dollar question, sorry, as they say. It's really hard to predict, and every time you try to give a range, I think in terms of days, it's always going to be off. But if I look at sort of what's happening around the world with current projects that are there, and also sort of looking at the wider sort of implementations that are happening and various projects, I would say that it feels like it's a 2-3-4 year time horizon around them being implemented, perhaps a little bit longer as well. I think for some of the larger economies and the larger central banks and the reserve currencies of the world and so on, I think there is more to sort of manage and deal with, more challenges to deal with, of course. And I think it has to be very deliberate and very well thought through. But I think it's an inevitability. The question is the time frame, of course.
Yeah, no, indeed. And Kimo, what's your view on that question?
I think it's pretty much the same. I think 25 years ago, when I started in central banks, and there was actually a sort of an early CBDC in Finland called the Avanta. But I think at that point of time, and even 10 years ago, everyone was thinking that there's too big of a single point of failure around the cryptography, that central banks didn't seriously start to think about these type of things. But now with Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies been running for a while, I think there's more the view that technologically maybe we're getting to a state where it's possible to issue central bank digital currencies. And then there are a lot of drivers at the moment that are pushing also towards central banks issuing, like related to sovereignty, related to financial inclusion, the COVID, and so forth. So I think the last year and two has really accelerated the idea that the central banks are starting to seriously getting into the business, and then it's more about the timing and having the investment cycles as well when it happens in different countries.
Yeah, no, I mean certainly we've seen a lot of stuff coming out of the BIS about CBDCs and crypto or stable coins, that sort of thing. But anyway, Kimo, maybe you can go first on this next question. For things like cross-border payments between individuals, blockchains can certainly deliver big cost savings. However, when we look at wholesale financial markets, money transfer costs are relatively low, as was pointed out recently by a Fed official. So can blockchain technologies really do better than these well-established, well-understood legacy technologies within wholesale financial markets?
That's an excellent question. I think, but maybe just on the first one about the cost savings for cross-border payments. I think we've already experienced a lot of cost savings for cross-border payments by the fintechs, by Revolut's, TransferWise or Wise, and others, as well as then Swift's GPI program that brought down the time it takes. To do cross-border payments. I think we've already experienced a lot of that. I think for the it's always a battle between technologies. How can you replace an incumbent technology that is very good? I think that's going to be, of course, much harder than building in areas where you don't have an incumbent technology and building from ground up, like what happened in Africa with the mobile phone like network building and adoption because they didn't have landlines. So I think it will be harder to for new technologies to enter markets where we are already well served with existing fast and cheap payment methods.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, and John, what are your thoughts on blockchain technologies versus legacy systems in wholesale financial markets?
Yeah, I just wanted to add a couple of points and a couple of thoughts regarding that. I think when we look at that for cross-border wholesale, and also retail to a certain degree, but the wholesale, specifically in the wholesale area, we look at CBDCs as a new format of money, a new format of central bank money, to be precise. Yeah. And I think with that comes different things. And I think it's not necessarily about the speed, although the intention is that it's faster and it's instantaneous and it's sort of a liability of a central bank, basically, and eliminates counterparty risk in the process of a transfer of money and so on. So it's not just about the format of money, but also the geography of money. And what we mean by that is there can be, I think, in the implementation of these wholesale CBDCs, entirely new ways of transacting. And imagine a scenario where you have central bank money issued in one jurisdiction used to settle transaction in another jurisdiction. I think that will transform sort of the financial ecosystem and financial markets. And I think this is the part that is really exciting. It's not necessarily about the costs, because that is obviously a dimension, and it's a lever that the current systems and the incumbents can sort of play with and so on, and also timing.
Extra functionalities, basically.
Exactly. Right. So the new functionality behind that, I think that is really the driver, and that functionality can create entirely new models of transacting. And I think that's where it becomes really exciting. And perhaps it's not just cheaper and faster, but it can do entirely new things that we never dreamt of before.
Okay, well, that's a very, very interesting thought. Okay, John, just moving on a little bit. I mean, central bankers, they've expressed concerns about fiat currency-backed stablecoins. Often it's been via reports from the BIS, for example, you know, that they could undermine the monetary sovereignty of central banks and even pose systemic risks. In your view, are they correct to worry about stablecoins?
I think the stablecoins are filling a need in the market, and that actually it demonstrates that CBDCs are the timing is right to start launching them. I think they serve a market need and have value, of course, because people are using them to settle transactions and so on. I think in terms of whether they should be heavily regulated out of existence or whether they should be sort of challenged with CBDCs, I think we'll end up with a tapestry of different alternatives. Stablecoins serve a very specific need, a market need. Yeah. They are, in the absence of a CBDC, they have some functionality that is useful. With CBDCs implemented, they could potentially become less useful in certain type of transactions, but I see them sort of coexisting.
Yeah, I mean, did you have any ideas where they might be able to carry on, you know, carving out a niche? Would it maybe some programmable functions or some voucher-like characteristics maybe?
Indeed, yeah, I think there's some functionality where you're looking at those areas where they can provide certain features that a CBDC isn't really in the remit of a central bank currency in order to provide. And I think that's where it can become interesting, and their coexistence, of course, with other central bank monies.
Sure. Okay, lovely. Okay, Kimo, what's your view on this whole stablecoin debate?
I think there are already a lot of like private currencies circulating around, private liabilities. So I think they serve a purpose. I think the central banks, when I was also at the European Central Bank, for example, we were constantly looking for different types of claims that would have more sort of like payment related functionalities, and whether they would be a threat to the confidence of the current into the currency. And then maybe like think about taking some action if that becomes more real. But most of the cases, these have always rather small. And if they remain in for specific purposes rather than becoming widely accepted to pay for everything, I think probably the central banks will just leave them alone. I think, though, as part of the CBDC discussion is also to start taking more thought into the regulation of these digital liabilities that circulate around, in the same way that at some point of time the legislators said that issuance of cash is a monopoly by the central bank. So we'll probably see some type of legislation like that come also in the digital space as the CBDC and conversations and plans and legislation gets more developed.
I mean, talking of regulation, I mean, do you think they'll try and regulate, if they do indeed go down that road, do you think they'll try and regulate these, the organizations behind these currencies, stable coins rather, like money market funds or banks or shadow banks?
Eventually, I think they will all become part of the existing regulations. So either they're issuing securities or either they are coming to the derivatives regulations, or maybe they are currency. So I think those conversations are already going on, like what are these different forms of claims and what kind of regulations should they be getting or be folded into the existing regulations that we already have.
I mean, John, before we move on, I mean, do you have any views on what might be the most appropriate form of regulation for stablecoins, if indeed regulators decide to go down that road?
That's a difficult question to sort of, answer from a regulator. Well, not a regulator necessarily, but I think what we see sort of is, I think there will be indeed elements of regulation that will come in, I think, from a stablecoin perspective. It's hard to see how far it'll go, and also, of course, which jurisdiction. And I think some of this will sort of, some of these stable coins will foster sort of innovation and creativity in the marketplace and so on. I think when it becomes closer to sort of where, you know, you're getting into potential for investors to lose their money or sort of households to sort of compromise their life savings and things like that, their savings and so on. I think that's where it becomes very difficult, I think, and the regulators need to play a role, of course, in that area. But I think the challenge, of course, is that a lot of these, you know, implementations that are out there, stable coins and various other, you know, options and solutions that have been implemented, begin to get there's a lot of gray areas between them. So it's hard to really understand all of what they're doing. And I think that's part of the challenge. The regulators need to come up to speed with regards to what are these stable coins? Are they alternative forms of money? Are they an investment vehicle? What exactly are they providing? Are they a coupon or what have you? And I think in many respects, that's where I think the challenge will be in terms of understanding what they provide and what needs to or maybe not need to be regulated.
Yeah, no, I mean, all excellent points. Very, very good point. Yes, there is a whole consumer protection angle as well that needs to be considered. Okay, well, let's talk about CBDC designs. There's a retail model and a wholesale model. Developing countries tend to like the former for reasons to drive financial inclusion, whilst developed countries seem to prefer the latter. Now, John, can you discuss the pros and cons of each model and their likely impact on traditional financial institutions?
Sure. I would also like maybe just to clarify that in some advanced sort of economies as well, there's a lot of talk about retail models as well. And it's not necessarily just for financial inclusion, but also to provide alternative payment rails and as a means for providing a level of resilience in the wider economy. So I think there are, if I look at sort of all the examples that are out in the marketplace, I think there's a wide variety based on jurisdiction of interest on one or the other. But I think I would like to also introduce not necessarily another model, but maybe more a generalization, a general purpose CBDC that does both. Because I think in many respects, if you start with a retail proposition, a retail CBDC implementation, you sort of get wholesale for free in some respects. And I've said this, I guess, in a number of presentations as well, because the complexity of retail versus wholesale is, of course, much higher because you're dealing with consumers and you're dealing with a whole host of other things that you wouldn't have to if you dealt purely in the wholesale implementation. So I think but the solution itself, I mean, the implementation, the solution, the art design, the architecture, the overall approach could be very consistent throughout, whether it's a retail or a wholesale. I think where it gets fuzzy or where it gets more complicated, of course, is when you're having to deal with end users and consumers and what does it mean for them? And I think that's where the challenge really lies, I think, for retail implementations or applications, because explaining to a consumer that digital central bank money exists and how does that compare with, you know, the current methods of payment that they have in their wallet already. Yeah. And there's a plethora of those different payment options, be it sort of mobile phone payments, Apple Pay, Google Pay, and all the different sort of methods there, but also credit, debit cards, and other digital forms of payment as well that exist readily available. So I think from a consumer point of view, making the case for it is not straightforward because you also have to explain what is digital central bank money. Yeah. And also, wait a minute, isn't my money that I have in my bank account digital central bank money? And so then you have to go through, you know, an explanation around that as well. So I think there's an element of education and awareness on the retail side. On the wholesale side, it's much more straightforward because you're dealing with, you know, trusted entities that are all, you know, closed community of trusted financial institutions and intermediaries and so on that understand the space extremely well and try to derive benefits from a wholesale settlement and application perspective. But I think if I look at sort of the real value for implementations, I think is in the areas where there is the most friction. And I think, of course, it is very geography dependent, very jurisdiction dependent, and also is driven by strategic topics, nation state agenda items as well. So if you look around the globe, why are various central banks pursuing some of these things, these initiatives? And it'll be very much dependent on sort of where they are, where they want to be from their own central bank and economy as well.
Okay. Right. Well, Kimo, what are your thoughts on this topic? And maybe, you know, if you could give some views on the models that are most likely to be adopted and, you know, across developed and developing countries.
Yeah, I think I would agree a lot with what John already said. I think the benefits that societies will get are going to be much higher in the retail space than in the wholesale space. We already have digital versions of large value payment systems. So the added functionalities that a CBDC can bring to that space might not be so large and could also be actually delivered with the current technology. So you don't need a blockchain or a tokenized form of money that is issued only in the wholesale space. And I think many of the modernization projects that we currently have ongoing in the large value payment space, they don't actually consider a CBDC model there. And usually those have investment cycles of 10, 15, 20 years. So that might, at least for many of the modern countries, come much later, including the UK. We have a large modernization project going on. On the retail space, on the other hand, I think there are loads of benefits that that can be reaped from replacing cash, making payments available to people who don't have bank accounts, the unbanked. Most of the world's population, by far majority, I think there are 8 billion unbanked people in the world, don't have access to digital forms of payments to make payments online. So I think there's much more benefits globally on the retail side of things. Including also countries that are already developed. The reasons might be different, like John said, might be related to being more sovereign about the payment systems that you have, being more having more different alternatives for technology when you have cyber attacks from nation states. And other types of considerations that are equally important, or the considerations from treasuries, being able to issue directly to people subsidies or other types of benefits rather than going through the banking system for that. I think the retail CBDC will have a much bigger impact as well for the existing players, the card companies, the banks, depending how you design it. And we've actually developed a simulator to simulate the parameterization and design of retail CBDCs so that these type of conversations can begin. Should there be a cap on the balances? Should there be a cap on the payment sizes? How can we bring a CBDC without completely destroying banks' balance sheets through disintermediation? There's loads of questions around how should a central bank bring in a CBDC that is adapted well enough, so actually it has adoption, but it's not adapted too much, so that it sort of takes the business of all the other players in the payments markets away. So what is the sweet spot? And those are the type of simulations we can do with the agent-based modeling, is to build the economy or the payments systems and the markets in a miniature form on the computer, and then run simulations to see what kind of parameters you should have for the system. I think what will happen is something quite cautious in the beginning, because central banks are very risk averse. That will maybe used in some niche areas, maybe in conjunction with some government payments or other types of payments that are in a way on the control of the government. And then have that adoption run from that. It will not be a adoption like a WePay in China, where like in a matter of a few years everyone started using it. It will be much more cautious.
I mean, Kiwa, just to quickly wrap up on this particular topic, is it possible to design a retail CBDC that does not disintermediate banks, for example? Because you can have a situation where you're undermining their deposit base, their ability to be funded through deposits, which, you know, a lot of regulators view as a very important form of funding, as being good for financial stability and so on. So is there a way around that? Because that was an early concern.
Yeah, but it really depends what are the policy goals for that CBDC. Is it to be able to reduce fraud in welfare payments, for example? Is it to provide a means of payment online that is a backup for existing systems if there's a cyber attack? So I think it really needs to start from that. So what do we do it for, and what kind of policy goals or agendas do we have in bringing in the CBDC, and then figuring out the parameterization so that it fulfills its goals, but has very few unintended consequences. And those are the types of things that when we build this simulation model, we can see what could be the unintended consequences if I just do certain things, and what kind of parameterizations, like caps on the balances or other types of incentives that could be put on it, or that it's only used for certain types of payments initially, could be put there so that we achieve the goals without creating new risks.
Okay, and actually, John, just quickly, do you have any thoughts on the retail CBDC and sort of disintermediation debate?
I do. Just to add, I guess, to the discussion here, we believe in a two-tier model where we see sort of the commercial banks play a key role in both the distribution of CBDC, similar to how they distribute banknotes today through ATMs or through a branch network, and also retaining or maintaining sort of the relationship that they have with their customer base, their consumer base, where they do the KYC and AML today. I mean, at the end of the day, what we're talking about is a new format of money, and not necessarily as a competing sort of interest by central banks to sort of compete with sort of commercial banks. So I think it's an important point, because that also drives the kind of architecture and model that could be implemented into sort of with these kind of solutions. And I think this is an area where we through our engagements and various other sort of projects have come up with sort of this sort of two-tier model design, which is very popular, and it's also very I think it's central banks are gravitating towards that, because it feels that it sort of takes the best of every sort of stakeholder and puts that into consideration for a solution design. And I think these are the kind of things that you need to look at as well, specifically in the retail, where you have obviously a massive consumer base and you need to maintain those kind of KYC AML relationships that are already there, but also the trust of how you can distribute money and in exchange for deposits. I think in many respects, we sort of overlook the fact that, we talk about central bank digital currency, but for a consumer to obtain a digital format of this new format of money, they have to exchange it for something else. And typically that would be a deposit that they would have in a commercial bank. And I think this also sort of plays to the sort of this two-tier model, where you have central banks at the top and commercial banks distributing central bank money in the format, in the same approach that they would for cash and ATM, for instance.
Right. Okay. In fact, those are very interesting thoughts, John. Okay, Kimo, there's been much discussion about programmable money. Do you think we'll see programmable CBDCs maybe linked to, stimulus programs, to spur consumption, for example? You could imagine a central bank or a government distributing money to stimulate the economy in order, but you have to spend it within 3 months or something. Or they could do things, programmable CBDCs, linked to some sort of socioeconomic aims. What are your thoughts on that?
I think definitely. I think that's one of the key features. I think that will be very interesting to governments to be able to issue money that can be used only in supermarkets. The COVID checks would have been a great way to kickstart the CBDC to give people money to spend, extra money. I think, and those are the type of things we're actually already seeing in without the CBDC markets to be built on top of existing infrastructure. So I think, just related to that other question previously, I think it's super important that we when we develop the CBDC systems, we develop in such a way that innovation is possible on top of the technologies and an ecosystem builds that builds up there, that takes advantage of all the possibilities that we don't know what they all are. We're seeing, for example, just an example, my direct debits used to fail if I didn't have enough money on the account. But now, it's more smart. It tries it next day, gives me some information that I should top it up. So we're starting to see sort of very, very rudimentary forms of these payments just getting smarter over time, already in the existing payment system. So.
Yeah, okay, thank you. And John, what are your views on the likelihood of programmable CBDCs?
I think that, a broader comment. With regards to central bank and digital currency, having sort of a level of encumbered by programmability on top of it, I think that's something that we tend to sort of advise to stay away from. And the reason for that is central bank money should be completely unencumbered, just like a banknote is today. It has is completely fungible and communicates that value and transmits that value in the transaction. However, there are, of course, numerous applications where you can think of Department of Health or Social Benefits and various other state departments that want to add sort of or encumber the money basically and say you want to be able to use this as part of a stimulus payment. You can use it before the end of the month. You need to buy groceries with it and not alcohol or something like that. I think there are many ways that you can sort of encumber this money in order to stimulate the economy, in order to stimulate sort of and to provide sort of these kind of payments to sort of to the wider population. I think that is a different story than purely the pure CBDC story. You need to be able to program it, however, and so CBDC should have an element of programmability. How it gets programmed, I think, should fall into the purview of other agencies that distribute state benefits and other types of benefits on top of that. You can also see sort of other intermediaries create new types of financial models based on sort of that level of programmability as well. And that's where it can become quite creative, I think, specifically for state benefits and other type of government-related benefits. I think there's definitely a story to be told around that level of programmability. But just going back to the beginning and saying, you know, CBDC should in and of itself should not be sort of encumbered in any way.
I guess you could wrap them up in a digital voucher or maybe even some sort of stable coin. But thanks for those thoughts, John. Okay, Kimo, let's imagine for a moment CBDCs do become a reality. How would that transform the global financial system? I mean, for instance, I was watching an interview with the economics historian Neil Ferguson recently, and he suggested that such a development could actually weaken the US's grip on global payment systems. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
I think that's exactly the goal of some of the projects is to take control of the payment system, be in control so that no one else can, in a way, through sanctions, cripple your payment system or at least parts of it because this is under your control. I think El Salvador that recently adopted Bitcoin was just because they were quite dependent on the U.S. providing them cash and coins, and during COVID that became difficult. These are exactly many of the reasons that many of the central banks and governments are looking into CBDCs.
Yeah. Oh, okay. And John, what's your view on that?
Well, I mean, one of the key reasons why many central banks look at implementing these solutions is basically sovereignty. At the end, it's a sovereign nation state. And today, with, I guess, the high degree of concentration of payment systems, payment networks, the financial plumbing that we have today, this has become more difficult to retain a level of sovereign control over these kind of systems that are in their country. Yeah. As a result of that, they need to have an alternative, and I think this is it doesn't necessarily mean that it's sort of sanction oriented. It could be also finance oriented, in other words, the stability of the country or anything else, geopolitics kicking in as well. So I think many central banks are looking at how they can maintain that level of sovereign control of their financial marketplace domestically. And as a result of that, they look at CBDCs as a way to do that in a digital world without sort of relying on paper banknotes and various other coins and stuff to be able to sort of supply the marketplace. And I think this is a very recurring theme. And I would look at sort of the kind of projects or the discussions and the considerations. A lot of CBDC projects are not your traditional cost-benefit analysis of looking at why do this, is it faster, is it cheaper, and so on. It's more about sovereignty and control. And it's more about sort of maintaining that, and it's right at the heart of any financial system of a country. And I think that's quite an important point, and one of the key reasons why they look at implementing CBDCs.
That implies that in some cases, countries may pursue a CBDC project, even though it may not be running on the most efficient platform. I mean, could that be a case? You know, maybe because it's not, the systems behind are actually quite good.
Regardless of the efficiency, the thing is that we see that this is a parallel and alternative payment rail at the end, without requiring sort of even the commercial banks within a country in order for it to operate. This is also the social contract that we see between central banks and the citizens of a country or the residents of a country. And regardless of whether, you know, it's intermediated by the commercial banks or other payments providers or even external organizations. And I think this parallel payment rail, this alternative, provides a level of resilience in the economy, and enables people to transact digitally, and regardless of how efficient it already is. It's just an alternative, and again, it provides that level of sovereignty, control, but also the resilience in the wider economy.
Okay, lovely. Thank you for that.
May I just add one more thing there? So we haven't mentioned cash here, which is the current non-digital central bank currency. So cash, of course, is costly. So many of the arguments for bringing a central bank digital currency is about being able to offer the public another payment means other than cash. Because if you're an island state, if you have a lot of islands, you have to carry that cash around. It's very expensive. So that can be a very, very beneficial from our cost-benefit analysis as well. The other story around cash is that although the cash in circulation is increasing, its function as a means of payments is declining everywhere. So it's useless, and it's being replaced by other digital forms of payments. But there is also the argument that maybe the central banks actually should be providing also a digital means of payment for the digital world, and not just stay in the cash side of it. So I think that that's more of those arguments, and these are different countries' central banks, depending on the situation, look at these different drivers differently. But one driver is definitely the decline of cash.
Okay, that's interesting. I mean, good point, actually. Okay, Kimo, this is a sensitive topic. There is a certain level of suspicion that CBDCs will ultimately be about control, about the government being able to know everything about your finances at any time. If they are to be widely introduced, how can the authorities and central banks reassure the public that this new form of cash is a net public benefit?
Yes, I think a key feature of cash is that it's anonymous. So if you do surveys why people use cash or what they value about it, it's anonymous. And the central banks have been very adamant about it, that it should remain anonymous, have not been, even though maybe technically it starts to be possible to start tracking cash more granularly. They've been very reluctant to do so. I think, continuing from that tradition, the CBDCs can be set up with different levels of anonymity. I think then it boils down whether people trust the authorities to keep that anonymity or not. And I think probably they can gain that trust if they want to set this up as anonymous means of payments.
Okay, and John, what is your take on that debate?
Yeah, it's a varying degree of, I guess, anonymity, pseudonymity in these kind of transactions, and these become design choices, I think, in solutions. And I think there are a couple of things regarding this to consider as well. The first one is sort of how you design such a solution, and what is the role of the central bank in terms of what kind of an environment do they want to create for digital money, digital central bank money, and to be used? And I think as it is today, many economies, many sort of central banks don't collect this information, don't want this information. It's not really in their purview of understanding sort of individuals' transactions and so on. It is interesting from an analytics perspective to understand velocity of money movement and velocity and also other how money flows through the economy. I think that's more at the macro level than it is at the individual level. And I think from that perspective, it has provided some very interesting sort of understanding of money flows. But these are design choices that you can bake into the solution and will vary in degrees of anonymity and how they are implemented. The one thing to consider as well is that today, when we transact digitally, there is an element of bank secrecy that is already involved, for instance, in our transactions. And if I transfer funds to you, for instance, my bank would know about it, your bank would know about it, I would know about it, and so would you. Yeah. And there are not many other intermediaries involved in that sort of in that transaction. And I think this is also something that you can carry over into the CBDC world, at least baselining it and saying it is equivalent to or similar to the way you transact today. Complete anonymity, as you probably know, is very difficult to achieve. It may not even really be desirable either. However, people have an expectation of privacy, and it is one of the key design considerations, of course, for CBDC solutions, and very much will play a key role, I think, in those implementations going forward.
No, I mean, those are all great points, particularly from a technical perspective. But I just wonder whether they wouldn't need to go, the authorities would need to go a bit further, or the government even, and maybe set up an independent parliamentary committee to supervise the issuance and use of CBDCs, or maybe even set up an independent audit office or something to track how central banks and governments are monitoring the use of CBDCs, something with a sort of high public profile that people can kind of understand. I mean, do you think it would require maybe that sort of thing to really drive their acceptance?
Maybe, but I think if you design the solution appropriately, it could be sort of, I won't say anonymous by design, because of course anonymity is it's a scale, right? But it could preserve high degrees of privacy for individuals and their transactions. And I think that's where finding the right balance will be very important, finding the right sort of blend of features and privacy and anonymity in day-to-day transactions will be key. There are solutions, of course, that allow you to have very high degrees of anonymity. And how you implement them will also play a key role in sort of their adoption and usage, but also in how they get rolled out as well. So there are various solutions that are much more centralized, other ones that are more distributed, and they have different features. And anonymity is one of the sliding scale features that you would expect to see in those kind of implementations.
Okay, Kimo, just let you have the last word on this one. So do you think, you know, we'll need to consider things like parliamentary committees or some sort of special new audit office or something to make sure that, you know, these CBDCs are running the way that they're supposed to, and, you know, preserve the right level of privacy and so on?
I think that probably the current sort of controls are already sufficient. The central banks are usually under parliamentary control already. I think they are trusted parties, and they can probably convince the public especially through experience, that you know, like the payment methods are safe and efficient and anonymous as they have been in the past.
And to conclude, I'd like to thank Kimo and John for taking part in Global Risk Regulators Regulatory Podcast Series. And if you'd like to listen to more regulatory podcasts, please visit www.globalriskregulator.com. And you can also subscribe via Acast, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. And finally, I'd like to wish everyone listening to stay safe and well. Thank you.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.